Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 298, my conversation with artist Natalie Grigson. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. Sign up today for your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. When you sign up, you get a free audiobook download as well as access to hundreds of books and podcasts. And every single month when your account gets charged its monthly fee, you get a new free audiobook download. So it's included with that monthly charge that you get. And then anytime you want a new book that costs something, you just download it, but you can do it at a much lower cost because you have an account. There's also so many things that are free on there. I have been, as you know, deep in my research for my Salem Witch Trial book using Audible and listening to things while I'm doing the dishes or, you know, driving around getting errands done and stuff like that. It's just such a great resource to have to be able to listen to books while I'm doing other things so that when I come and I have those moments when I can sit down and do my writing, I can spend time actually getting into the writing because I've done all this research in my other time. Audible is a great resource for that. If you're into doing research, if you're into writing something, you want to work on a certain project or learn everything about a certain topic. But it's also a great spot if you wanted to read any kind of novel, any kind of book that you're interested in. Maybe you want to hear about, you know, true crime. There's a ton of podcasts on there. It is a great thing. And of course, you can listen to Yes But Why podcast on Audible app if you like. So go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy to sign up and get your account today. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by PodcastCadet.com. PodcastCadet.com is the company that my husband Chris and I run to help podcasters. We connect with people and help them on a situation-by-situation basis. If you contact us and you need us to show you how to use, you know, like one of the Adobe programs to do editing on, you know, video or audio, great, we can help you with that. Or if you need us to connect you with marketing, I just recently signed up with Annie Schiffman, one of my previous guests, to do an arts accelerator. She's a great marketing person to talk to. We will connect you with these people. We are out there meeting new people and connecting with podcasters all over, and we just want to help new podcasters. So if you need help, go to podcastcadet.com. Maybe there's some information there for you already, but if not, just contact us through the website and we will help you in any way that you can. We will help you in any way that we can. And if you end up buying something from us, you know, you can just use code YBY20 and you'll get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. Let us help you make podcasting a little bit easier this year. PodcastCadet.com. This week on Yes But Why, I chat with author, artist, and facilitator Natalie Grigson. Based in Austin, Texas, Natalie is a best-selling author as well as a teacher of improv, creative writing, and art classes. Natalie is also my writing coach and has been for the past year on that YA novel about Salem witches I was talking about. Listen in as we talk about confidence, mindfulness, and why I believe Natalie spends all of her leisure time on yachts. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 298, The Magic of Natalie Grigson's Determination and Imagination. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is
Yes But Why.
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 This is the Yes But Why podcast.
So I like to start at the beginning by talking about childhood creativity. What were the ways that you were playing with your siblings or your friends as a kid?
Mm-hmm.
Man, okay, so I have early memories of finding really creative ways to play with things that weren't toys. And I don't know why I did it, because I had a lot of toys, but I distinctly remember taking plants and creating characters out of the plants and making those be the characters. And I remember, like, this is just one of the weird things I did to play, but like, I remember getting in trouble once, and then it was like, go sit in the bathroom for a while, which was a weird punishment, but it was like, okay, I'll go have like a timeout sitting in the bathroom. There's not a lot to do in there, I guess. So I remember taking these seashells that were in there, and they were characters really easily. And I was just always playing with like weird shit laying around.
Was it always creating characters?
Yeah, it was always, they were characters, and also things were, like, trees were characters and named and had personalities. And, you know, I would have these like relationships with these trees that were around the house. And I was also often a different thing than a human. So I was always playing like I was a lion or a wolf. I got a big scar on my knee by being a wolf when I was about 4. It's still there. Because for some reason, my dad thought it was wise to listen to a 4-year-old say, "I don't need stitches, Dad." And like really take my word on that.
4-year-olds are very convincing. Yeah. I have one. He convinces me of lots of things. I'm like, yeah. I guess you're right. I mean, the lollipop does seem like a good breakfast. All right.
Man, you're smart. Yeah.
4-year-olds are the best politicians, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So I like that you were always different characters, like different, you know, beings. Were you like magical beings as well, or just like animals?
I was mostly regular old animals, which kind of, now that you mentioned magical beings, I'm like, wow, I didn't even think of that.
Well, no, because I was just thinking about myself, like, because you mentioned the trees in your yard, and I was like, uh-huh. Oh, yeah, I had like a side yard, and there was this little concrete block that I used to go stand on and do speeches to no one. The trees, I guess. But I was like, oh, man, I never like connected with the trees. There were a lot of trees there. Right. And I just thought how that was. And you mentioned animals. And I remember I'm always imagining that I'm sort of the head of something standing on the block telling everyone what they need to do. I mean, I couldn't. Like a tiny little revelation about myself, but you know. So
like
when you mentioned the animal,
or were you?
No, I'm like the boss, like of whatever.
Okay, you're the boss, the boss of the trees.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But there was often a lot of magic in what I imagined, and so that's why I asked about the magical beings for you. It's okay. I mean, animals are pretty magical when you think about
animals
it.
Animals are
so.
Pretty magical. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean.
Yeah. I don't remember pretending to be anything especially magical. But I am going to think about it now for a while and really go back and look at videos and things.
I really feel like, though, we only play with what we have presented in front of us. You know what I mean? So, like, we only know what. So if you were a big nature kid, like if you're outside playing outside, yeah, then nature is what is going to be your main thing. Like, I watched a significant amount of television as a child. So there were a lot of, you know, child cartoons that influenced certain ways that I thought. I mean, there was even, I've said this before, but there was a pay-per-view channel on my TV that like got caught and stuck, and it played the same movie, Defending Your Life, over and over for like a week. And I was a child and I watched it a bunch, and it's about the afterlife. And I only realized recently that movie like is the total basis for my own personal philosophy about the afterlife. And I was like, oh,
that is psychologically, you know, very interesting to me.
But it just came, that was what, you know, was presented to me, right?
Yeah.
So
over
in
over
your scenarios, yeah, well, you know, that's how pay-per-view worked back then. They just had one channel was that thing, and then you bought the, like, showing at 8 p.m. or whatever, and it turned on.
Right,
but
right.
It was weird that it was just, like, open forever. Certainly my parents didn't pay for a 24-hour viewing of this, like, movie.
Yeah.
It's a very unusual movie to want to watch over and over. And yet, again, in my adult life, I've watched it over and over because it holds this, like, warm place for me.
Wow, that's cool.
Well, to this random anecdote that I'm sharing with you, are there any, like, things like that for you, like toys or games or movies that are special to you from your childhood?
Yeah. I also watched a lot of television and I watched a lot of movies. And my parents were not specific about which movies I could watch. I think if they heard this, they'd be like, we did great. We were very careful. I mean, I have specific memories about, like, I watched Alien really early, like 4 or 5.
Good. Good.
Yeah. And that was the beginning where I was like, I love movies. And I also, like, I remember loving the feeling of being able to watch movies that other kids couldn't watch. You know, like when you're a kid, you're like, oh yeah, I'm watching R-rated movies and that makes me cool.
Yeah, I remember.
And so that, I mean, for good or bad, watching that movie at 4 or 5 probably influenced something about where we are now. I don't especially remember it as like an impactful movie, but I mean, psychologically and developmentally, it's got to be. So it's in me deep somewhere.
I mean, it's a pretty solid one as far as, like, you know, female empowerment. And if you step outside of it, it's also kind of cool for, like, makeup artists and, like, in fact, that is how I
maybe
watch.
That's where I get it.
Maybe all all the makeup that you do. Yeah, that's the only way I can watch horror movies is because I decided that my husband really wanted to watch them all the time, and I was like, I can't. Oh, I don't want to do it. And he was like, it's not real. Just, like, watch the movie. It's fine. And so I started to. So then I watched this documentary on this guy, Tom Savini, who does makeup and prosthetics and creates, like, the bloody explosions and stuff. And understanding him as an artist really helped me to, like, distance myself slightly from watching the movie. So now I can watch them and I'm on the outside going, like, I'm, you know, their graduate professor going, like, ah, yes, I see what you did there. I enjoy the use of latex mask. That blood made from? Maple syrup? Excellent job. A+. You know, it, like, helps me watch it without being all like, oh my God, it's really happening. Like, so I don't know.
You've got some distance from it. You can watch it more detached in a way.
Yeah, like, in fact, speaking of Alien, I didn't watch it because I was scared of it for my whole life, and then, like, very recently I watched it. So so, like, watching it, I was able to.
I haven't seen it since apparently I was like 4.
Yeah. Oh, you didn't rewatch it. I feel like maybe that's more of a traumatic experience than it is an inspirational film.
I've watched it since then.
It does hold up. It does. I'm fine.
I'm doing great.
It's all right. It's all right. No, I mean, it's okay. It definitely holds up. You know, it's a solid movie about a girl who solves everything when everyone tries to sabotage it all around her. So she's, you know, and who doesn't love Sigourney Weaver? I mean, like, there's just nothing not to love. She's everything she's great, in. Great. A+. Doing it.
Powerful woman lead, Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose that's very helpful, you know, and empowering. If you watch that young, you were like, yeah, I can do that. No problem.
I can do that. Yeah.
I'm available.
I picked that attitude up from somewhere. So maybe it was Alien. Maybe it was somewhere else. But I definitely picked it up somewhere along the line.
Yeah. Do you would you say that you are personally confident, like confident in, you know, sort of presenting yourself, like you can handle yourself in situations?
Yeah, I think, you know, I get the feedback that I present myself as confident isn't the word I get when I'm getting like feedback. It's like, wow, it's tough, intimidating, you know, like, unapproachable. You know, these are for certain people. I also get the opposite feedback, which is like, you're such a weird goofball. You're so like silly and light. So somewhere in the middle of those is, I think, where I live. And then I can lean far to one end or the other.
Hmm. As far as the way you personally feel, not necessarily what other people have said, though, do you think that you feel confidence in yourself? Like when people say things, are you like affected in a way that's like, oh man, I wish they wouldn't. I mean, not that like we aren't affected by people's things, but I don't know. Sometimes right. people say stuff about me and I'm like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, how do you feel about it?
I feel very confident in most areas. And then I have certain like Achilles heels, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I think that's just natural. Yeah.
Yeah. Certain things that seem totally innocuous to other people might really get into me. Yeah. You know, so I've written several books, and one, when you publish books, you get a lot of reviews.
Oh, yeah.
And you get people that love them, and you get people that don't love them. And you're like in that process of publishing books and submitting them to agents and doing that whole long process. There's a lot of no's, like a whole lot of no's before yeah. you get a yes.
Yeah.
And that never really bothered me. So I think if that's confidence, sure. There's also something in me that's so very stubborn and determined, to my detriment much of the time. but also like it really allows me to kind of like push through and not take on, the negative feedback. I'm hearing what I'm saying and I'm like, oh yeah, the fight I just had with my partner has a lot to do with this.
Yeah. I mean, it can be hard because the reason why I ask is that, you know, as a writing teacher in my experience with you, you know, you're very strong and you're confident. And I appreciate that when you say something, it's like, she really thinks it, you know? And, and it's just like, there are some people who are in the world and things happen to them. And then there are people who are walking strongly down the road and grabbing things as they go along, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess I've always seen you as the latter. There are a lot of, like, even, you know, before we ever connected, not just our connections with, like, Austin Improv, but, like, finding out that you're, like, publishing books and getting all of this work done and, you know, accomplishing these goals for yourself on your own. That's, I think, sort of a confidence. And I also, when you mentioned the like stubbornness and stuff, I was like, I think that's kind of part of it. Like, if you're going to hold yeah. your head up high, you have to be a little stubborn, especially when people are all like, get your head down. You don't need it up. And you're like, okay, that's what you think. Great. Have a great day.
Yeah. Yeah. If I want to get what I want to get done.
Yeah.
There's some stubbornness you need.
Yeah. It's yeah. the only good thing I kept from the Boston. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. like the total attitude of all like, okay, well, you can keep your opinions. All right.
Yeah. Like look, that, you're doing this. Yeah.
All right. Well, enjoy those thoughts. Yeah. Like that's the way I've made it through so many things. Also, yeah. like, I don't know about you, but sometimes I just walk through the door with the idea. I've definitely gotten a lot of jobs because I walked in acting like I was already working there. And they were just like, who's this girl? And I was just like,
how long has she worked?
How's
there?
It yeah. going? What's happening? Right. And yeah. and then they were just like, well, get her in because she's fun, you know? And I yeah. feel like that. I feel like that's the case with you as well. That's also why I always give you a hard time and say that you're at yacht parties, because I just imagine you with like, you know, with like wandering around and everyone's just like, oh, Natalie, how are you? Oh my God, Natalie, beautiful today. Oh my God, that's great. Here's a cocktail. Like, I don't know. You know, wow. people are just handing you things and you deserve those things.
Money and yeah. things and jewelry puppies.
Yeah. Absolutely, Natalie, puppies.
Here's a puppy.
This is your puppy if you want it. You know, I don't really. That's fine. They take it away.
Yeah. So, yeah, you, for context, often tell me that I have several yachts, or I am on yachts. I'm not actually clear on the story exactly myself.
It's more that you are a person who goes to parties on yachts. Like if there was
parties.
Yeah. You know, because you are a unicorn, you're from Austin, right? Uh-huh. So I assume that there's sort of like an underground elite of Austin, right? And uh-huh. In the underground elite, there are a lot of both billionaires and then children of billionaires, right? And so there's yachts just on every river and lake in Austin.
All over,
just like
Lady Bird
so
Lake.
Many. And then they have parties, and at the party, uh-huh. all of the elites and the top cultural elites as well are there, uh-huh. because I don't think that you're like in the mob or whatever. Like, no, of course not. Uh-huh. Cultural elite though. So you're there because you're a best-selling author. So while everybody enjoys the fact that I do have these fantasies about how you have yacht parties and how that's an actual real thing that we've discussed in the past, let's instead take a little sidestep to the old best-selling author situation, which I've read.
Which is why I'm on the yachts.
Yes, so exactly. That's how you get on the yachts, right? Yeah. As soon as you sell the best.
Sell a certain amount, and then they're like, Natalie Grigson, invite her. Put her on the list.
Absolutely. There are like three people in black suits with Blackberries, and they're just like quickly inviting people to yacht parties. Like that's how it's working.
Yeah, I think you're right. Wow. I never knew the behind the scenes part of it. I just get the invitation. So.
Oh, see, I'm of the class that is the people organizing and like hanging the lights for the yacht party. Like the people who are serving you hors d'oeuvres. Those are my people.
Got it. Yeah.
Oh my God. So, silly anecdote aside, so you have confidence. And the reason why I brought that up is you have published books, right? How did you get there? How did that first one happen?
The first one that I wrote or published?
Whichever one you'd like to talk about, because I guess wrote is a big accomplishment to have finished something like in a complete. Okay, this book is done. Did you ever publish that first one that you wrote?
What was the first book I wrote? You know, the first book I wrote, I believe, was called Matthew Templeton and the Enchanted Journal. Oh. And I wrote it when I was still in college. I think I was 19. And, I guess I was in school, you know, I was in school full time, and somehow I was like, I'm going to write a book. And I did. And it is kind of a middle grade, fantasy adventure with lots of quirky, weird characters and silliness, lots of humor. Like, I think that my sense of humor is in all of my books, except for one, which I can talk about later.
The Dark series.
The Dark one.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that. Sure.
Well, yeah, there was a pandemic and then this book happened. So, that was the first book I wrote. And I actually, I got a literary agent at the time when I was like 19. She was like, I love this book. We're going to get it published. And she started submitting it.
Like, how did she read your book? Did you send it to her?
Yes. So I finished it and I was like, this one's done. And I submitted it to several agents. You know, you write the query letter. Do we know these things?
I don't know. Tell me. What do you do?
Oh, man.
I don't know how to get a literary agent. Tell me about it.
It's a whole dance. It's a whole process. Okay. So a
lot of letters.
A lot of learning really well how to tailor a letter. You know, have your letter template that you've created and then tailor it so that it works really well for each agent, which is a great skill to learn as far as just applying for jobs, all the things you need to do that. But I sent it out. I sent several letters out to a bunch of different agents that I just, I guess, Googled, maybe Yahooed. I don't know. This was a while ago.
You asked Jeeves. It was all right.
I asked Jeeves. Yeah. And Jeeves was like, oh, here's a list of middle grade agents. And so I sent it to someone whose name I don't actually remember at this point.
Fine.
And she submitted it to several middle grade publishers and then kind of came back to me after a while and was like, Natalie, I'm really sorry, but I am not going to be a literary agent anymore. This business is, she kind of, I don't know if I was the person she needed to tell this, but she was like, the business is dying and I'm out. And that's how that ended.
Wow. And that's the story of how your first novel made a woman quit the literary world. Wow. That's.
Yeah.
She's like, listen.
It's as though I had a partner and then he was like, actually, I've decided to be gay now. You know, it's like that turn, I turned her away from books.
I feel like it'd be it would almost be worse where it'd be like, I have decided that I'm going to go to a monastery. Like, I can no longer talk. A silent monastery forever.
I'm done with.
I can't do people or any relationship that's not just another man who wants to tend this garden. Like, I cannot. No, thank you.
Yeah. And I thank you for that.
And it's because of you that I realized. Yeah. This world of women is not for me.
Yeah, this world at all. She did not actually specify that it had anything to do with me. I didn't actually take that on, but now I will.
No, you're just the straw that broke the camel's back. Somebody probably like just sent a rejection letter that you would have read and been like, ah, whatever. And she was like, I can't tell poor Natalie this. This can't be my life, you know. She probably loved your book and somebody was like, what, I'm not gonna sell this, and they were like, she was like, how dare you, and that was what broke her, because that person was just too rude.
Could have been. And she also, I mean, to be fair, she had lots of other clients, so I'm not gonna take all the responsibility. So I'm just gonna put that out there.
I like the idea though that you guys didn't know each other at all, but she like got really detailed about her personal life. She's like, hey, how's it going? By the way, no one's gonna buy your book. And also, have you been aware of how dark this life is? You're like, wow.
I'm not doing well. And my husband is gone and I haven't seen him in weeks.
Novel has been the shining light in my week.
Yeah.
So did anyone after this one quit the business? Were there other literary agents that perhaps stayed?
I did. I had a couple of other literary agents over the years.
Great.
I think that's an example of my stubborn determination.
Yeah.
Because the woman quitting the business because of me did not dissuade me from continuing to write books or even submitting them to agents. And then even when, how did this work? So my Peter Abel series is what is now a best-selling series. And that didn't start well. You know, it's one of those stories that you always hear like, oh yeah, there was 1,000 rejections and then the one, you only need one yes. It was kind of like that, but there was no one yes. What happened is I have this friend who's a really brilliant writer here in Austin. His name's Owen Edgerton. There's a little name shout out. He's also in the improv community, so you might know him. And he told me at one point, like, think about the books that you really love and that are similar to what you've written, and then do some digging and find out who is the literary agent behind that author, and then email that agent and say, hey, blah, blah, blah. You know, I just love your client XYZ. And in my case, my dream person is J.K. Rowling. And my books, the Peter Abel series, is kind of almost like an homage to Harry Potter in a way, because it's about a boy wizard who is an adult now. And he lives in the world of fiction, like the world behind the page, that is, you know, a very real world in these books. But he's like a washed up adult boy wizard at this point, and he's no longer being written. So he's like going to Wizards Anonymous meetings, and there's like a whole community of ex-boy wizards, because like what happens to all these boy wizards when we're not reading about them anymore? Like, they're boy wizards from this time to this time, and then what, you know? Probably doing a bunch of cocaine and like not doing so well.
Tough.
It's tough. The world of fiction. It's not easy.
Yeah.
So I wrote to J.K. Rowling's literary agent, and I was like, hey, love your client, J.K. Rowling, you know? And they wrote back, one of the agents from the agency, and she's like, I love this book, and I'm going to represent you. And that was great. And it was very excited. It was one of those, like, I think at the time I was very interested in like putting things out into the universe and the magic and the synchronicity. And when I got that email back, I was just like, yes, this is it. And she did represent me for a while. And I think we got some leads on turning it into a movie, actually, rather than publishing it as a book. And I don't remember how those things, like, they escalated and it was exciting, and then they kind of de-escalated. And I don't remember exactly why, but I assume it's because movies are like that, I hear. But at any rate, after that, I just decided, you know what, like, I want this book out there. I have plans to write two more books in the series. And I hear there's this thing called self-publishing, so maybe I'll do that. And as I was thinking about doing that, I got this, I don't know how I got this. It was one of those other like magical universe moments, but I got wind of some competition online for this new press. Kindle has a publishing part called Kindle Press, and they were doing some competition at the time. And so I entered that book into the competition, and it won. And so it got published by Kindle Press.
Wow.
That was a long story to say that's how that happened.
No. It's important to understand different kinds of things like that, even writing competitions as a thing, like, and right, how that can connect you to, you know, publishing options and stuff like that. Now, was the agent along for the ride here? Was the agent like, yeah, let's self-publish, that might be an idea, and then like, hey, what about this writing competition? Or so did you stop working with them after the movie didn't work out?
Yeah, I believe she was still representing me at the time, but because I found that and I pursued it on my own, it was not anything to do with her. And I think it was at that point I was like, you know, I'm going to not work with you, because apparently I can just do this on my own and make more of the profit. So I'm going to do that.
Yeah. Probably best if you wanted anyone to read it. The unfortunate part about things being made into a movie is a lot of times, you know, you probably just missed the part where they buy the script and then never make it, but they own it. Right. So you can't do anything with it ever. And you received X amount of money and that's it. Like, the nice thing is, you know, if you can get, if it gets all the way past that point where they actually do make it, great. But like, that's the hard part of that process. And yes, I don't think it had anything to do with you or what you wrote. I'm pretty sure that's just how movies get made. It's like three people are like, this is a great idea. And then they go to another meeting and the fourth guy goes, what? No. They're like, well, I guess we won't do it. So they keep adding people to the room. And if they keep saying yes, it eventually gets made. But, you know, like the 10th guy comes in and he's like, guys, what are you talking about? And they're like, we don't know. Forget it.
We don't know anything. Yeah.
Yeah. That happens.
Man. Yeah.
That's how I imagine all movie making is, by the way, everyone who's listening. I don't actually know how movies are made. I'm just like literally have an imagination.
It's just a hallway with a long series of rooms and you walk from one to the next and there's more people in them.
Yeah, yeah. And they generally agree with each other. It's like a thing that they like try to do. But every once in a while, somebody has an opinion and it's not the same.
So, not the same.
Yeah. And then they put a halt on it and that's it. If one person doesn't like it, all of America won't like it. So that's it.
I think you're right. I think that is how movies get made.
Now, everything that you've said so far has been like just chock full of, you know, hot tips for writers, you know, as far as like getting a literary agent, you know, connecting with somebody, Owen's advice about connecting with somebody who really creates the kind of stuff that you love, that you want to be part of, you know, that genre, that situation, because I think that's something that a lot of us don't think about as we're writing is like, what genre are you writing for? And then like that way you can hone in on what are the other books like it? And then who publishes those books, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. I'm sure at this point too, because I recently met a few voiceover artists doing audiobooks, like then there's the next step of like where, what audio people are you getting to do your audiobook? Like crazy. The whole package of the situation. Now after you published with Kindle Press, is this when it was wildly purchased? A lot of people were really super into it and that led to the continuation of the series?
Yeah. So the first one, I think right when it was released, was very successful. And that was cool. That was exciting. And I can't remember if I had already started the second one. I must have already been writing the second one or soon thereafter started it. But I ended up publishing it again with Kindle Press because they were just doing such a great job promoting it. And I kept hearing from other author friends, like, you should stick with this because our stuff is not promoted. We have to promote it. And actually, anyone who's a writer out there maybe listening to this, I hear that that's, and I'm seeing more and more that that is the landscape these days. It's like, there's just such a huge amount of stuff to consume that it's no longer the publisher's real job to promote it. They'll do a little bit, but it's like, oh, where are you on your social media? You got to be really like making this happen for yourself. They're not going to help you very much. So often these days, if you go with like a traditional publisher, you're getting the benefits. There's just less benefits now. Because you still have to do all the hustle of creating your whole marketing campaign yourself, pretty much.
Man, that's wild. I have definitely interviewed quite a few people who do marketing on this show. And the idea of that landscape and the way that that's built, like, it's really fascinating to know, because I usually think of it from the standpoint of like a performer or even a theater teacher, like where you're like, who's looking at my stuff? How are people going to find out that I have a class? And you know, doing marketing work with them on that kind of stuff, because it was like, you know, there's no one to help you for that. You know, if you're not Second City, people aren't just like, oh yeah, let's go ahead and take a class with that person, right? So yeah, I've thought about that from that standpoint, but gosh, I hadn't really thought about it from a writer standpoint. I didn't realize that was something that was going on. That's crazy.
Yeah, the last agent I had really drove that point home to me, because she was like, okay, like, I can sell these books, but you've got to build your social media presence on your own. And that was the first I really thought about that. And this was, I don't know, several years ago. And I was like, does that mean I have to get on Instagram? Like, yeah, you got to get on Instagram.
I know. I feel the same way. I'm on Instagram right now with the podcast. And I just like, what am I doing here? I'm like an old person who's like, what does this button do? I don't understand. So, yeah, I'm a full advocate of if you have the money to hiring somebody else to do it
hiring
for you.
Marketer.
Because,
that's
I mean,
the one thing,
it's a crazy, ridiculous thing that's like super hard to do. And also, like, I'm really sorry, but like, you and I, and probably mostly artistic people listening, have some skills, but marketing might not be it. And that you don't need to feel bad about that.
Yeah.
Like some people have other skills. You're all right. You've got yours. They've got theirs. And you know,
we hire each other.
That exactly. That's the other thing. Yeah. In this world, we got to take care of each other, right? So they are artistic in that way. Please. You have figured out how to do magic with that social media and figure out how to make people look at things. Let me give you some money. How can I support you in your business, right? So I guess the unfortunate part always is that artists are pretty much just left to create their art. And then, you know, if you don't have the money to find other people to help you, well, then too bad. That's a darn shame.
And you have a lot of art in your closet.
Yeah. Yeah. Though some people are just randomly amazing on social media. And I'm always impressed with that when I'm like, how did you get 4,000 followers? 4,000. Look at me. I'm like 1,000 years old. 4,000's like 4,000's like nothing. They're like 4,000. You have 4,000. Like I do have 4,000. So yes, not a lot. I'm like millions. 4 million. Is that enough? Should be
4 million's a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say that's a whole lot.
All right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Like honestly, don't
we
know.
We can measure this by like Kardashian levels.
Oh you know? Yeah. All right.
A lot of those.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, I mean, how much are you doing to be a household name in a household that, like, tries to not see you? Like, I, like, actively put effort into avoiding the Kardashian situation. Can't avoid it. Can't avoid it. Still everywhere.
Yeah, you know, you're right. Like, I've never seen the show, and I've never intentionally sought out Kardashian information.
Never Googled them.
But it comes to me.
I've never looked at a photo. Or clicked on a link about something they're doing. Never. Nope. Somehow everywhere. And that is marketing. Like, no kidding.
I've looked at photos. I've looked at photos because I had to marvel at the either like absolutely like science defining proportions of Kim Kardashian or the Photoshop of the ratios of her
I mean, realistically,
body.
They invented those waist cinchers in the like 20s. You know what I mean? Like, like we could all wear a corset if we wanted. You know,
sure.
and you know, hey, maybe that's what her human body looks like. And you know, God bless her if that's what she's holding on to. But like at the same time, like it's like we were talking about earlier, the things that you need to put in when you're an artist. Like, does she have to look good all the time? Does she always have to dress really well? No. I'm sure she'd love to be in some sweatpants, right? She's a person, right? But she can't. She can't because
it's
she opened the door to her in the inside of her house to create part of the life. And so now she has to. It was like, what was it? Somebody was talking about how after Beyonce had her twins, and then she like was in a photo shoot and they were like, oh my God, like, I can't believe she like got her body back. And I was like, poor sweet woman birthed those twins. And then they took them to another room and put her on a treadmill and was like, drink this kale juice. Like she's not allowed to have like a nice day. Like she's not, no, she had those babies and then a nanny took them. And then like they made her stop eating.
And
like, yeah, I mean, this is
it's
not,
so rough.
It's a fully designed, it's not even rough. It's the work that is put into it. And I'm just saying, you got to appreciate, you know what I mean? It's like, hey man, I'm not putting that effort in. No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. But I don't have a team. Right. And as we move forward and like build our situation, the team gets bigger. You've talked mm-hmm. about a small team that you've had with the literary agent, right? And then even just having like friends who are also writers that are advising you, that's sort of like a literary circle, you know what I mean? That's mm-hmm. in that can help you in that.
Right.
I feel like everything in art right now is making me think how we need a team, right? So, and, mm-hmm. and our discussion about like finding a marketing person to work with and like right. the 47 people that, you know, Beyonce requires to like wake up in the morning, like there's just people. You need people, right? And we build it together as we're developing our art and what we are putting out there in the world. So after right. you finished your first series and it was going well, how did that move forward for you? Like, how did you want to progress your the building of your team, the development of your career as a writer?
Let's see. After that series, I think somewhere in the middle of writing that series, I had this brainwave about a different series. And I think I put it on pause. I put it on pause and I took a long break between writing book two and book three of the Peter Abel series. There's only three books in the series. And in between those two books, I actually had this dream, and this has never happened to me before, but I had an actual dream while I was sleeping about like this book, a book idea. And when I woke up, I was like very inspired and I started writing this book. And the concept was I want to create something really magical and cool for kids that are like, you know, fourth-ish grade to maybe seventh-ish grade. I think those are that's probably the key demographic there. And I want it to be like as though they've stumbled upon a notebook, like walking down the street and they're like, oh, what's this? And then they open it up and it's written to them. And it's from like this part of them that's like their inner wisdom, their inner self. And so it's called Just Call Me Is, the first book. So Just Call Me IS, your inner self. And it's like written to the reader from their inner wisdom. And it tells them this story about a character and it like follows her life. And so they get this fictional story told to them, but then like throughout the books it's illustrated. So I also illustrate. So I illustrated the book and then in the back, it's all these like journal pages and exercises and games. And like, it's extremely interactive and there's these places that they can just like draw and do all their stuff in it. But the whole idea was like introduce kids at a young age in a fun, interactive way to mindfulness, you know? So there's like, and I didn't want to make it specifically like spiritual. I certainly didn't want to make it religious. So I wanted to make it just, you know, accessible mindfulness, like being present and developing the skills to be present even through like hard emotions and things like that and make it fun. So yeah, I woke up and I started writing this book and I started drawing it and kind of designing it. And then I believe I wrote that book pretty quickly because, you know, it's illustrated, it's for a younger audience. It's not a very long book. And then I did a Kickstarter campaign for it. And we raised something like $15,000 and we published it and everybody, you know, all the backers got their books and, that was really fun. And then because I'm so stubborn and whatever else I am, I was like, I'm going to do it again. So I wrote a second book in that series called Call Me Perfect. And it's just, you know, it's similar. It's from the same narrator. It's written to the reader from their inner self. But that one focuses on body image and like developing a healthy relationship with your body. And for the same age group because, you know, when I was that age, I did not have a healthy relationship with my body. And I wish that I had found a book like that. So I did the same format and everything. And I was like, I'm going to do another Kickstarter because those are fucking stressful. And I was like, I need more stress in my life. So I'll do it again. And I did it again. And we raised another like $15,000 or something. So I published these two books. And that was an adventure. It was stressful, high stakes, and fun at the same time.
I feel like you joke, but I feel like you like that, you know, like that high stress, high stakes, like how, you know, at this point, I like the idea that you like got a like major literary agent and then you were like, you know what? I got this. I'm doing it on my own. Like oh my that. God. That's a wild situation and speaks to what I meant when I brought up confidence at the beginning. It was like, yeah, see, like you were like, it's fine. Listen, sweetheart, I appreciate that you do that for your job or whatever, but listen, don't quit the biz because of me. All right. But I gotta go. I don't know if you've heard. I won the competition. I'm in. But it's great. I like just love the empowerment that you have of yourself. And I think that there's something to be said for that because, you know, your books are out there. People can read them. People can buy them. And what is that if not what we're trying to do? Right in our creation of art, like we were talking about making the movie. A lot of people write stuff and then it gets put on a shelf. And don't get me wrong, there's a number of things that I've written where I was like, God, I'd love to sell them and have someone put it on the shelf, please. But at the same time, like, yeah, sure, I'll take some cash. No one ever needs to see that slop, but you like it, you take it, kiddo. But at the same time, like, most of the stuff, it's messages you have out to the world. You want to like discuss things and present ideas that maybe you have that you don't know that other people have. And then, I mean, isn't that why we all read books anyway? Is just to be like, hey, I didn't know another person looked at the world the same way I do. Like, you know, I don't know about you, but I've often thought of myself as quite singular. Like so many times in my life, I like look at the internet or talk to a person and I'm just like, okay, I guess nobody thinks the way I do. So that's cool.
I'm all alone, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's just sort of like I have a specific way and I'm confident in that way where I'm all like, this is the way the world is. Yep. Mm. And I'm fine. If you want to think of it a different way, great. Whatever gets you through it, bud. It's a long time. The same time, like, there's something great about putting this out there for kids so that they feel like they have someone that has their back. Like there, this time in my life, middle school was a definite rough time. I mean, I personally moved from the public school to the private school because I was being bullied at this moment. Mm, right.
Yeah.
Like these kinds of books would have been great for me. I was such a deep thinker and everybody was like, what can be done about her? And then I was like, can I go to that school? And my mom was like, yeah, that's fine. And I was like, cool. That's where I'm going to go then.
Nice.
Not because I'd ever spoken to a person there or knew anything about the education. It was just like, this place stinks. Can I go over there? And they were like, yeah.
Like, that's cool that your parents listened to you and they said, sure.
Yeah. No, my parents are, I'm very lucky. No, in my journey in my life, I think that's very important. And I'd love to hear about, you know, your family support of you as well. But I mean, my family has just taken me around to random things and let me do things. I mean, they drove me to every college I wanted to check out. And like they were everywhere. I drove to Ohio. Mm-hmm. We took a family road trip to Ohio to look at Kenyon College. My mother flew with me to California to look at a college in Claremont. Like, ridiculous. Who does that, right? These wonderful humans that are my parents, right? They supported me no matter what. I remember my dad dropped me off at my first apartment in New York City, which was frightening. And he was like, are you sure this is where you're going to live now? And I was like, it's going to be great, Dad. Don't worry about it. Jessica lives here. Because I had a friend who already lived in the apartment. It was like 45 roommates. It was a ridiculous situation.
Oh, okay.
And he was like, okay, that sounds good.
I support you.
Good luck. And he hugged me and he was like, call me if you need anything. And this is before cell phones. And so he drove his car away and left. And I'm sure was all like, dear God, please save my child from the horrors of that place. It was a lovely apartment, but it definitely was scary. And if I were a dad walking my daughter into a place, I would also be like, no, no, no.
Yeah.
So, so I, sometimes you get that, you have that super support. I had some sweet, sweet support. Tell me about your support system.
Support for my creativity. You know, I actually,
or lack thereof.
Yeah. Someone just asked this question on Facebook specifically towards women. Actually, she said something around, were you supported creatively or were you kind of like discouraged from it? Anyway, you can edit that one out. That's beside the point.
No. I talk to people all over the world about it. It's a big topic that I think is important. Some people's families just tell them no, to the point where half the people I'm talking to have another career, but they're writing their novels or teaching their improv classes or whatever. You know what I mean? So, I mean, and it's all over the world. Like, I thought maybe some countries, the parents would be like, yeah, I'm into it, or really not into it, where it's like, don't tell my mom. You know, but how did it go for you?
Well, it's so interesting to me because I think so much of it has to do with privilege as a whiter, just like socioeconomic ability, right? Like, because I was really lucky to be privileged in a lot of ways. I didn't have the pressure that I think a lot of people have to like do something practical, right? And so when I was really little, obviously that wasn't really a concern. Like, Natalie, get a job. What are you doing? You're four and you're coloring. Jeez.
Seriously.
Get it together. But no, when I was really little, my parents definitely encouraged the weird, all the weird in me. They really wanted a weird kid and they got one. So they were happy about that. But like,
again, born and raised in Austin, you know.
Yeah.
It's a thing.
Yeah. So all the playing, pretending I was an animal, playing with the dog more than other kids, doing all of the non-traditional things they liked, until I chopped off all my hair. My mom cried. She likes to tell that story, but I don't remember it. But yeah, so they were really encouraging when I was young. And then I remember I was also really lucky to go to this. I was in a great school district and it really emphasized the arts in a way that I don't even know if schools can do anymore because I hear things have changed. But I had some teachers that were just like so very encouraging of my writing and my visual art. So I was like, cool, I'm going to really pursue this. And then I went to college. And I've always been really interested in human psychology. And I thought I wanted to, I don't even know what do you call this? I didn't want to be a psychologist, like a therapist. I wanted to study human psychology, like in a lab. And I thought that would be really a great fit for me. But I remember starting out on that track for maybe like one semester in college. And something in me was just like, man, I love this. It's very interesting, but it's not like the thing for me. It's not what I'm like born to do. And I remember my dad at one point saying, you know, like, because I was talking to him about this and I'm saying, I wanted to get into writing or like back into writing because I'd always been writing. And he was like, you should definitely do that. Like, that's the thing that you are great at and you love it. Like, do what you love. And I think even then I had the practical sense of like, but I'm not going to get a job doing this. And he was like, that's not really the concern. Like, I think that if you love it, you should do it. And then the things will follow that need to follow.
Yeah.
So I did that, and I majored in creative writing and minored in art. And then...
Where'd you go? UT?
I went to St. Edward's.
Oh, fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a really great college experience. It was definitely not the traditional college experience at all. I think I had that one in high school, middle school. that is, you know, like the partying and all that. But by the time I was in college...
party time in middle school? It was like a lot of like junior high... You guys hanging out at the quarry, drinking a lot. Yeah, I get
that. Middle school was a wild time for me, let me tell you.
Yeah.
middle school was a weird time, actually, because I did get into this party scene in like seventh or eighth grade. And we used to sneak out and take taxis, like, you know, pre-Uber, pre-friends driving, we would take taxis to, I don't know, people's houses in the middle of the night. And it was just so incredibly dangerous. Like, you're 13, you're getting into a taxi with a stranger at 2 a.m.
I honestly think 13-year-olds are the most dangerous human beings on the planet, and we're just not giving them enough credit. Like, they just don't, they don't have, even people in jail are like, hey, man, I've lived a life. They know the consequences sometimes of their actions as they're doing it, right? But 13-year-olds don't know. They have no frame of reference. There has been no, previous to now, no one's even considered them vaguely allowed to do anything, right? Think about that. 10, 11? No, get inside. What are you doing?
Yeah.
But 13, you're like, I don't know. You want to go to the mall by yourself? Sure. Go ahead. Take the bus. Good luck to you.
Oh, my God.
You know what I mean?
So many bad decisions.
Terrible decisions. Oh, my God. Yeah. It's when I started smoking. What?
Me too.
Terrible. Yeah.
I guess I was a little, no, I was not 13 when I started smoking. I probably had a drag of a cigarette around then. It's like, ew, I don't like it. It was smart.
Yeah.
It's gross.
Yeah, I was not smart. It was not smart. But yeah, I mean, it's a wild, intense time. Now, to bring it back, though, it seems like you had a lot of support. The tone of you telling this story, as you told it to me, I was really waiting for a shoe to drop. Like, I thought at one point you're going to be like, and then I talked to my dad and I was like, what do you think? Should I write? And he was like, absolutely not. What are you going to do? How are you going to pay your rent? Good Lord, Natalie, get your head out of your ass. Like, I really thought it was going to turn around there in the telling of the story. At any point, I mean, like, because you're talking about this, is it because you think because of the privilege, because they had money, they, like, let you do stuff? Because I'm going to be honest, I know a lot of people who came from money where their parents were, like, way more intense about, like, not doing arts. Mm-hmm. And, like, what do you mean? You have to be a lawyer, or, like, get out of town. You have to get a job in finance, or any number of things. Like, you need to have a salary all the time, you know.
Right.
Tons of stuff. I mean, I've known people all over, you know. Now, I think something that your dad said did ring true, and I wanted to respond to it to tell the audience, which is, it's not this idea of do what you love and then everything else will fall into place like it's a fairy tale, but
right,
if you can, it's almost like self-care. It's like, if you can establish something in this world that you love and that you can do consistently that, like, keeps you going, that's a great thing to have as a life tool forever. Now, can you get a job doing stuff? Yeah, sure, bet you can. Jobs you can get. You want to work at Starbucks, they'll hire you. No problem. But you could probably also use the writing skills that you have to get jobs, to do other kinds of things, to write about stuff that's not, you know, magical boy wizards, you know, and then someone could pay you for that, you know, those kinds of things. Also, to the beginning of our discussion about, like, your confidence and determination, you know, that is also a good pairing for freelance. You know, a lot of people need to have a job, need to work. They can't handle the idea of not knowing when their next paycheck comes from, or it being random, or it all happening in 1 month in a year, and then you got to save it for the rest of the year. But that's a thing. That's a thing that when you choose to do freelance, you don't know. I mean, heck, I was just having a conversation just now with my husband where I was all like, yeah, we're putting a lot of money in savings because I learned my lesson the last couple of years that savings was a good idea. But there's a temperament and you have to believe in yourself to do it. And I think that your family having the confidence in you to do it is what enables you to do freelance, because your mm-hmm. other jobs, correct me if I'm wrong, your other jobs are mostly writing, but for, you know, not creative, but like writing for marketing or writing for a business journal or writing for TV or I don't know, whatever. What are the kinds of ways that you are freelance creating revenue for yourself in this world where, you know, maybe doing a deeply stressful Kickstarter isn't the best way to get some cash?
Is that a question? Did you say?
Yeah. What are your freelance ways? Okay. Yeah. What are the ways that you are doing? What sort of freelance?
I heard the whole rest of it, but I didn't hear the what.
I do a long.
I do a long. That makes the question.
It's me. It's not you. In what ways are you doing freelance jobs that help you bring money in other than writing novels?
Yes. So. The main source of my income is freelance. And I also, so I teach a creative writing class and have a writing group and had a couple of writing groups going, but now I've kind of pared back because I was teaching like four nights a week. So I teach creative writing and I teach improv and I freelance edit and write and occasionally illustrating. Freelance illustrating is less of a thing because I think that's just a harder job to come by. I've found like it's not usually people that want to hire a freelance illustrator. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's absolutely.
It's a weirder job.
Well, no, also I think it's more of a, not union necessarily, but it's like you get hired to be like a staff writer. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like a staff illustrator. You're like, okay, right. You work for them now. Cause like I've known people in my life, other artists that I've known along my journey where there were these two guys that I met when I lived in New York City. And they were illustrators and they worked for Nickelodeon. Like now mm-hmm. they do their own comic books and I want to say the other one works for Marvel, but it's like, but yeah, I mean like that's how it works. They drew their own stuff and then they got hired with a company and then they just do a bunch of stuff like that. So yeah, I think you'd have to really be like, okay, this is my career now, if that's what you wanted to do.
Yeah. And that's kind of the thing is like, I love writing and I love drawing and I love doing weird makeup face art and I love like doing improv. It's a little bit difficult to really hone in on one thing that I'm going to say, like, this is the one thing that I do.
Yeah.
So I think that's why freelance has worked well for me in those ways. Yeah, and I kind of cycle through these things. I'll be really in an art phase for a while, and right now I'm not. So then I'll be in like I think that's how I kind of discovered, oh, I like putting makeup, like art on my face because I'm tired of this same thing with the paper and the things and just wanted something different.
Yeah, you needed a different canvas. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Did the, just as a side question, because I wonder personally, did the makeup, on your face art start for you during the pandemic?
That's when I got more into it and started playing with like visual effects. Is that the word? I don't even know. I'm not a makeup artist at all, guys. I think visual effects are a different thing in film.
maybe, but I think they get what you mean. You were trying to create not just like
makeup.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you just Google it?
No, but I thought of it really quickly.
Yeah. I think that's it. I think that's probably it.
Yeah. It started as kind of a thing I tried a few years ago, which means pre-pandemic, I suppose, but what is time anyway? And then during the pandemic, when I was like locked in my home, I was like, I just gotta do something. And so yeah. That's when I got more into it.
Oh, interesting. So it was more an artistic project for yourself. I wondered if it was a, like I mentioned, you know, doing the Zoom now was like a, I need to see faces. Like, you know, you can go out in the world and live in the world these days and not see a face. You just see eyes and a mask. But so the idea of face is really, I'm obsessed with it now. Like,
wow.
Like,
yeah.
As I get older, I'm going to become like a nose person or like a lips person. Like I don't look at, like, you know, when they say like, oh, they have a beautiful eyes. I am straight for the mouth. Like, I'm just like, what's your mouth look like? I want to see it. How does it move around? So cool.
Yeah.
Like, because I miss it, you know? So I wondered if your makeup artist was more of a like celebration of the face that we don't get to see.
No, not at all. But I love that. I think I will tell people that from now on.
Good. Yeah. Feel free to use it. I'll cut it right out. Yeah,
I started it during the pandemic as an expression of my face, which was covered up. It was commentary on not being hidden from the world.
There you go. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. All the different facets of me. That's all the different ones that I did.
Yeah, exactly. Great. Yeah, thank you, Amy.
Yeah, here we go. We just whipped that right up. That's like a piece that you can sell that. Apply to a competition for art with that. You get it.
Get a grant for $200,000.
I bet you could do that. Legit. You tell me, I'll cut it right out of this episode. No one will ever know that we came up with this. But you know what, though? Yeah. One of the things that I really love about art, though, and even talking to other artists, is this exchange of ideas. You know, the idea that as we're chatting, we can inspire each other. And that's my favorite part of every single one of these interviews, is being able to talk to an artist and figure out like what they're excited about and then just sort of feed into that. And if every person, heck, if even one third of the people who I talk to on this podcast leave it with a like new idea that they can go out and develop, I win. You know, like how great is that?
Yeah, that's awesome.
And, you know, talking about so to go back to what we were discussing a moment ago, which was like how the money comes into the house, I really think that, you know, if you can have the confidence to, and the patience to kind of be freelance, if it works for your personality, it's going to work for your personality. I mean, I don't think I could do it any other way now. I'm just so, it's just the way that I am. I can't like, I need like 47 different projects and like different things, you know?
Yeah.
Now I know nobody can see me, but like at my desk, I have like 7 different notebooks and each notebook represents like a different project that I'm working on. Right. And it's like, they mean different things to me. Like I'm like,
right.
Oh, I have a new idea for the novel. Let me pull that one out. And I write something in there. And then it's like, oh wait, this part over here, this is the project that I have about this art piece, and write it down, you know? So it's just like, it's just the way your mind works. And I think you should embrace the way your mind works and, you know, enjoy it, you know, be the artist that you are and not who you think you should be. So I'm glad that everyone is supportive of you, and I am supportive of you. You have been very supportive of me in our relationship, and I really do appreciate that. It's been wonderful. You're an excellent teacher. Anyone who's listening, take all of Natalie's classes, any classes you can take from her in person or online, and, you know, join the writer's group. It's been, absolutely helpful for me. And I say this,
does
not just
know
to,
that you're writing a book. Have you talked about this?
No, I don't
Amy's
know.
Amy's writing a book, everybody.
Yeah.
She's in my creative writing group and she's writing a book.
All right, so hey everyone.
So we have to all hold her accountable.
Oh no, what's gonna happen now? Crap. Yeah, no, I was actually gonna do it. I just didn't know when it would be done, but now it's on the internet.
It'll be out in 2 months.
What? Good Lord. 2 months. Oh boy, I could do so much else in 2 months. Golly gee. Yeah, well, so yes, I am writing, working on a novel, and it is because of Natalie and her support and inspiration and you know, continuous having my back in the experience of it. And holding me accountable as that. And I appreciate you. And I also, I wanted to thank you so much for being on the show. I appreciate you talking to me and exploring these topics and, you know, exploring your journey as it went along. I look forward to sharing with everyone your books, and hopefully we'll get some more, millions of reads, on your, yeah, on your new stuff and your, yeah, old stuff as well.
I really appreciated this, and I had fun.
Yeah.
So thank you for having me.
Good.
Thank you for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all of our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.